Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Brought to you by Capital One, where you can open a savings account in about 5 minutes and earn five times the national average. Just imagine, five times more savings toward that overdue home addition, maybe even an addition on that addition. This is Banking Reimagined. What's in your wallet? Capital One, N.A. member FDIC.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm James Reynolds, and in the early hours of Friday, the 17th of January, these are our main stories. President Trump's impeachment trial has formally begun in the US Senate, with the lead prosecutor saying that the president should be barred from holding public office for abusing his power. Mr. Trump's revised North American trade deal has been approved by the Senate with support from both Republicans and Democrats. A study has estimated that sepsis kills twice as many people around the world as previously thought, making it a bigger killer than cancer. Also, in this podcast,
the anti-doping team turned up unannounced at the training camp in Kapsabet in the west of Kenya.
And guess what happened next? A top Kenyan athlete quickly climbed through a window and jumped a fence to evade the officials. We begin in Washington with words which have been spoken about a president just three times in American history.
Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons are commanded to keep silent on pain of imprisonment while the House of Representatives is exhibiting to the Senate of the United States articles of impeachment against Donald John Trump, President of the United States.
With this announcement, the impeachment of President Donald Trump moved to its decisive stage, a trial in the Senate. Just a couple of hours earlier, Congressman Adam Schiff, a member of the lower house, entered the Senate along with his fellow Democratic prosecutors. Mr. Schiff read aloud the articles of impeachment. They accused the president of abuse of power and obstruction of Congress. Mr. Trump is accused of violating the Constitution by pressing Ukraine to investigate his main political rival, the former Democratic Vice President Joe Biden. Mr. Trump has denied abusing his power and obstructing Congress. But Congressman Schiff said that no president had ever sought to impede an impeachment investigation so thoroughly.
President Trump, by such conduct, has demonstrated that he will remain a threat to national security and the Constitution if allowed to remain in office, and has acted in a manner grossly incompatible with self-governance and the rule of law. President Trump thus warrants impeachment and trial, removal from office, and disqualification to hold and enjoy any office of honor, trust, or profit under the United States.
Congressman Adam Schiff. Then a crowded and tense Senate waited for the Chief Justice, John Roberts, to be sworn in to preside over the trial before he, in turn, would administer the same oath to the 100 senators who will hear the evidence. I spoke to our Washington correspondent, Gary O'Donoghue, as he was following the events in the US Senate, and I began by asking him first to put the whole event into historical context.
Third time this has ever happened since the founding of the Republic. You going back to the late 1780s until the first president of this country, George Washington, took office. There have been two since then, Andrew Johnson in the 1860s, Bill Clinton in the 1990s. Neither of those was removed from office as a result of their impeachment. And we're not expecting Donald Trump either to be removed from office. But nonetheless, a hugely historical moment for the senators, for the House, for the country. We saw those articles delivered earlier, James, and it was a sort of solemn, I thought it was a pretty solemn and spine-tingling moment, quite frankly. You know, the Americans don't do pomp and circumstance in that kind of way in parliamentary terms, but this was one of those moments where they did. And now, as you say, we will go through the process where the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court is transformed from Chief Justice into the man who presides over this trial in the sort of chair of the Senate, and he will swear in all those senators. But don't be kidded, because looks like a trial, looks like a criminal process, but it's political.
Gary, just picking up on that point, you and I are both following events in the Senate. The Chief Justice of the United States, John G. Roberts, has just walked in. He's wearing his black gown. He's now taking the two or three steps up to the dais where he will meet the President pro tempore of the Senate, Senator Chuck Grassley. They look like they're about to take that oath of office. Both of them have pieces of paper in front of them. I wonder if we can hear what they have to say.
Senators, I attend the Senate in conformity with your notice for the purpose of joining with you for the trial of the President of the United States. I am now prepared to take the oath.
Will you place your left hand on the Bible and raise your right hand? Do you solemnly swear that in all things appertaining to the trial of the impeachment of Donald John Trump, President of the United States, now pending, you will do impartial justice according to the Constitution and the laws, so help you God?
I do.
The Chief Justice is now about to swear in the senators.
At this time, I will administer the oath to all senators in the chamber in conformance with Article 1, Section 3, Clause 6 of the Constitution and the Senate's impeachment rules. Will all senators now stand or remain standing and raise their right hand? Do you solemnly swear that in all things appertaining to the trial of the impeachment of Donald John Trump, President of the United States, now pending, you will do impartial justice according to the Constitution and laws, so help you God. The clerk will call.
They have now been sworn in, those senators. Gary, that is a moment of history.
It's quite something, isn't it? It really is quite something to hear that unfolding as we speak on the floor of the Senate, the Chief Justice there assuming the chair. And of course, the big question about him is, what kind of chair will he be? Will he be an activist chair? Will he be a pacifist chair? He can make some judgments about evidence and he can make some judgments about rules, but he is still subject to votes of the Senate. If there's a dispute, if one side wants something to happen, another side doesn't want it to happen in this trial, then they simply vote like politicians. And 51 votes gets you your way and overrules whatever John Roberts wants to say about it. So this amazing hybrid process that we've got really built into the Constitution by the Founding Fathers. This is not an accident. They wanted it to be a quasi-legal but political process because they knew the stakes were very high.
Gary O'Donoghue in Washington. A short time after these proceedings, President Trump, speaking in the Oval Office of the White House, said that he predicted his impeachment trial would not take long. And again, he dismissed the abuse of power charges against him as a hoax.
I can only tell you this thing is a big hoax. It's a big hoax. We call it, this is the current hoax. We've gone through the Russian witch hunt. We've gone through a lot of them.
As we heard earlier, President Trump's dealings with Ukraine lie right at the heart of the impeachment trial. But the government in Kiev has remained largely silent about what it did or didn't know about contacts between Mr. Trump and his aides and President Zelensky. But in a surprise move on Thursday, Ukraine started a criminal investigation into allegations of illegal U.S. surveillance of the former American ambassador in Kiev, Marie Yovanovitch. Jonah Fisher in Kiev told Julian Marshall more about those allegations.
On Tuesday, text messages, or WhatsApp messages to be precise, were released in the United States between an associate of President Trump's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, so the man in question is called Lev Parnas, and a Trump supporter. And in those text messages, it appeared to pretty clearly suggest that the movements of the woman who was, until May of last year, the US ambassador here in Kiev, had been monitored. That there were basically, in those messages, updates on her whereabouts, on her security details, and even some of them seemed to rather darkly suggest about the possibilities of what money can buy you in Ukraine, almost as if there was some sort of assassination plot. So the publication of those messages in the United States led to this announcement from the Interior Ministry here in Kiev that they will be carrying out their own investigation, that they believe potentially a crime may have been committed on Ukrainian soil, which warrants them taking a look at it. And they have asked for support from the United States in trying to look into it.
What sort of crime, Jonah?
Well, what they are saying is that the surveillance of a diplomat, because Marie Yovanovitch was the US ambassador here, is a violation of both Ukrainian law and also of the international conventions which relate to how diplomats are treated when they are in country. So those were the two things that were stated from the Interior Ministry. I think some eyebrows have been raised here that it's the Interior Ministry getting involved here, not the perhaps the natural branch of government that would be launching an investigation like this. So there are question marks over, almost always that's the case here in Ukraine, question marks over the motives, over the various parts, branches of government when they do things. But for now, the Interior Ministry says that it will be leading that investigation. It'll be interesting to see what sort of cooperation they get from the United States, because, of course, Marie Yovanovitch, she works for the State Department in the United States. So far, from the American side, there seems to have been very little interest into looking into the allegations which she has made in the past. In fact, that she left here because her security was at risk.
Jonah Fisher in Kiev. In other news, the US Senate has approved a new, updated trade deal with Canada and Mexico, sending it to President Trump to be signed into law. More from our North America business correspondent, Michelle Fleury.
This replaces the North America Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA, a 25-year-old deal that reduced trade barriers. Mr. Trump made repealing NAFTA a signature promise of his campaign. He, along with other critics, have long blamed the pact for encouraging U.S. companies to move their manufacturing plants south of the border to take advantage of low-wage Mexican laborers. To win approval for the U.S.-Canada-Mexico trade agreement, the Trump administration worked with Democrats to hold Mexican companies to environmental standards and hiring practices more in line with U.S. regulations.
Michelle Fleury. Foreign ministers from countries whose citizens died on the plane shot down by Iran last week met on Thursday and demanded that Tehran accept full responsibility and that it provide compensation for victims' families. The meeting took place at Canada House in London, from where our diplomatic correspondent James Robbins reports.
Because Iran initially lied to its own people and the outside world with emphatic denials that a missile strike brought down the Ukrainian Boeing, the level of anger when some of the truth started to emerge was magnified. After Iran itself, Canada suffered the greatest loss of its own nationals, 63 of the 176 men, women and children who died. So it was the Canadian Foreign Minister who chaired this first meeting of nations who lost citizens to agree the demands they expect Iran to meet. Those demands include a victim identification process conducted with dignity according to international standards, a thorough, independent and transparent investigation of the disaster, that Iran assumes full responsibility for the downing of the flight and pays proper compensation to the bereaved, and crucially, a demand that those responsible are held to account through an independent criminal investigation and then impartial judicial proceedings which conform to international standards. Canada's Foreign Minister, François-Philippe Champagne, was blunt.
There are many, many questions. Families want answers. All of the countries assembled here today want answers. The world is waiting for those answers, and we will not rest until we get them.
But the five countries represented also deliberately encouraged Iranian cooperation by welcoming what they called Iran's engagement to date. There is an awareness that Iran is facing a huge range of pressures from inside and outside the country, and that it's in the midst of an acute international crisis, including the slow collapse of the 2015 nuclear deal with Iran, which was intended to limit its ability to develop a nuclear weapon. So how should the outside world interpret an apparent warning from President Rouhani that the country is now enriching more uranium than before the 2015 nuclear agreement was made? That does not necessarily mean that Iran is closer to a potential bomb than it was back then. After all, the country had to surrender stocks of highly enriched uranium as part of the deal. But it could get closer than ever before. So finding some way of changing Iranian behaviour through new negotiations or otherwise remains a very high priority.
James Robbins. Sepsis is now a bigger killer than cancer worldwide. That's according to a new study. A report on sepsis, which has been published in the medical journal The Lancet, claims that the condition caused just under a fifth of all deaths worldwide in 2017. Our health correspondent, James Gallagher, told me what sepsis is.
It's nearly always triggered by an infection, but what sepsis is it the immune system overreacting to that infection. So your immune system goes into overdrive and it starts releasing chemicals throughout the bloodstream, and that starts damaging the body. So you can get organ failure and ultimately people can die.
It can kill
sepsis.
You.
Exactly.
Quite easily?
And it can happen quite quickly, yes. And the thing is, even if it doesn't kill you, it can leave you with lifelong disability.
Is it easily treatable?
It can be treated. It depends on what stage you're catching it. So if you give somebody antibiotics or antivirals, then you're treating the underlying infection, and that can lead to the immune system not quite having as much to react to, and that calms everything down.
Does it affect specific conditions such as childbirth?
The top two are actually two diseases, diarrheal diseases and respiratory diseases. So diseases of the lung are the two biggest triggers of sepsis. But there are a whole host of other ones. So if you're in a car crash and have open wounds, that can lead to sepsis. And the thing about childbirth is, you know, there's a lot of open wounds. It's a major area of major risk of infection. So yes, if you have an infection as a result of that, then yes, that can be another one of those triggers of sepsis.
What stands out to you in this report?
The numbers. The numbers are astounding. So we've thought that there are around about 5 million people dying from sepsis every year. This study says, no, it's not. It's more than double that. It's 11 million deaths a year. Now
that's twice as many as people thought.
Exactly. It's twice as many as people thought.
Why were we underestimating it?
Why? Because we did that little thing that so many studies tend to do, and they didn't look at the whole of the world. They looked at about seven richer countries in the world and extrapolated that to everybody else. What they missed was the fact that sepsis is an absolutely massive problem in the poorest countries in the world where they don't have the best access to healthcare. And when you start factoring that into the equations, so this study looked at 195 countries rather than seven or eight, bam, 11 million deaths a year, 50 million people getting sepsis every year. And just on that 11 million figure, that's one in five of all deaths caused by sepsis.
James Gallagher. Now, news of another podcast from the BBC World Service.
What do our most successful innovators think about the inventions they unleashed upon the world?
1,000 songs in your pocket. No one ever had that experience before.
Do they like the way it turned out?
Do you use GPS?
Oh, absolutely. But it dismays me because people are losing their capacity to read maps.
And are they proud of what it's become?
I looked over at the next table and there was a family and all four of them were sitting there looking at their cell phones. And I thought that was terrible.
In our podcast, World Wise Web, teenagers like me get to question the people who invented the tech we take for granted.
When did you come up with the idea, and what were you doing whenever you thought of it?
That's World Wise Web from the BBC World Service.
Are you kidding me? All this math, science, and code I've been learning can come together to create worlds and characters and tell stories, and that is like absolutely the coolest thing I've ever heard in my whole life.
Search for World Wise Web wherever you get your podcasts.
That is the most thrilling experience that a human being could ever have.
Now back to this podcast. A new United Nations report says that millions of children in Syria are continuing to face desperate conditions nearly 9 years after the war began. The UN Commission of Inquiry on Syria says that some children have been publicly put to death. Paolo Pinheiro is the chairman of the inquiry.
Boys as young as six have been recruited to participate in hostilities by warring parties, while rape and sexual violence have been used against girls and boys to punish, humiliate and usurpate. In detention, children have been used to extract confession from their parents, subjected to torture and ill treatment.
It is against this background that Syrians, caught up in the conflict, are eager to get the latest news and information. Many of them used to rely on a small, independent and politically neutral Syrian radio station that once broadcast in exile from Istanbul. But Radio Alwan was forced to close when the Trump administration made the decision in 2018 to cancel $200 million of funding for Syria's stabilization projects. Some of the radio station's staff have scattered across Europe in search of work, and those who have remained in Turkey say they now feel vulnerable following the Turkish offensive in northeast Syria. Emma-Jane Kirby has been speaking to some ex-Radio Alwan broadcasters in Istanbul.
Sayın yolcularımız, hafta içi tüm araçlarımız 8 vagonludur.
A metro station a stone's throw from Istanbul's tourist center, Taksim Square, where Sami, Radio Alwan's former executive manager, has just been pulled over by the Turkish police to have his papers checked. It's just a routine control. But when you're a Syrian in Turkey these days, says Sami, well, you have to be on your guard.
An officer saw my residence and knew that I'm Syrian. He said something I didn't understand. And when he finished checking, he said in Turkish and English, like, Syria finished. So I didn't know what that means. And I said nothing and I went on. Now the tension is up with Syrians. So I try to keep a low profile, like avoiding speaking Arabic in public transportations or texting in Arabic.
If the recent Turkish invasion of Kurdish-held territory in northern Syria has complicated an already chaotic war, it's also made things much more difficult for Syrian asylum seekers like the Radio Alwan journalists, all of whom only have tourist visas, which have to be renewed each year. 27-year-old Mariam used to work as the station's youth presenter.
We don't feel like quite settled here, not like we used to be. And the political situation has something to do with it. I mean, the beef between Turkey and Syria, Turkey and Europe, and like all of that, it's not really helpful.
Do you ever feel frightened?
Frightened? Yeah, actually, of course.
Rahaf, who is in charge of social media at Radio Alwan, cuts in. She tells me that when she first arrived as a refugee in Turkey, she was treated as a welcome guest. Now she feels she's looked at as the source of all Turkey's troubles. The next part of her conversation, she directs at the floor. I've always wanted to be a mum, she confesses. My husband and I have dreamed of having a son, but I've stopped myself thinking about it now because when you don't belong anywhere, when you have nowhere safe to bring up a child, is it really fair to push for your dream?
You need chicken. Chicken curry, yeah, it's nice.
Radio Alwan, of course, connected its exiled staff to home. But after briefly visiting Damascus last year, no one from the team felt home at all. Almost 9 years of civil war, says Sami, has left his former university town unrecognizable.
It was not the same place that I left. I don't consider it home. To have a place you call home, it has to be safe. I don't feel safe in Syria.
Rahaf tries to go back to Damascus every year to see her family. But with each visit, she tells me, she sees something more repulsive. I never, ever thought I would leave my beloved Damascus, she says. But now all I care about is getting my family out of there. Radio Alwan wasn't just a news station. It even had its own soap opera, Sad Northern Nights, complete with its own theme tune and a contemporary storyline which tracked and mirrored the horrors of the Syrian war. With no more funding, season 3 was never written, so I asked the team how they imagine the next episode would pan out. Definitely there'll be a happy ending, says Rahaf, and 100% there will eventually be a happy ending for everyone in Syria.
That report by Emma Jane Kirby in Turkey. In Kenya, a top athlete has run away from a training camp in order to evade anti-doping officials who'd come to do a test. The case comes as Kenya struggles to deal with a growing number of athletes who've been sanctioned for doping violations. Will Ross reports.
The anti-doping team turned up unannounced at the training camp in Kapsabet in the west of Kenya. After realising who the visitors were, the athlete jumped through a window and vaulted over a fence, presumably faster than any officials could have managed, if they'd tried. Bernaba Korea of Athletics Kenya confirmed the incident but did not give the runner's name. He or she is still likely to be punished. Mr. Korea said athletes who know they're guilty feel they have no choice than fleeing from the testers.
Will Ross. Now to the United States, and a television presenter there has apologized after appearing to mock the actor Joaquin Phoenix for a scar on his upper lip. Wendy Williams was accused of insulting people with a cleft palate whilst discussing the actor's appearance. She said, and this is a quote, "When he shaves off his mustache, he's got a hairline fracture. He's got one of those, cleft lip, cleft palate." The presenter then pulled up her own top lip, saying, "I find it to be very attractive." The audience then laughed. Wendy Williams was strongly criticised before writing on Twitter that she wanted to apologise to the cleft community. Divya Arya spoke to two people who were born with the condition. Mandy is in Maryland in the US and Chloe is in Ontario in Canada. First, Mandy.
Well, I was born with a cleft palate and a cleft lip. The cleft palate is an opening in the roof of your mouth, and then the cleft lip is more of a split down the front of your mouth. Some people have what they call like a bilateral cleft palate. So it would be like two splits down your nostrils, but I only have the one.
And Chloe, I understand you have a similar condition. How does that affect you in terms of how people perceive you and treat you?
Well, from a very young age, I've had to deal with a lot of criticisms that, like, you know, through school and just in regards to the scar that I have, and it affects, you know, the way my nose looks. And it's been hard since a young age having to, you know, feel, you know, a little bit like the odd one out and stuff just for something that happened at birth.
And I'm assuming you're aware of what happened with Wendy Williams. How did you find out about it and how did you react?
Well, I was on Twitter and I saw the video of her holding her lip up, and I was kind of shocked because usually that's the type of thing that I'm used to seeing from, you know, children in, you know, when I would go to school and stuff. So it was kind of surprising to see that from another adult, and then to see the crowd laughing at it as well.
Mandy, did that surprise you or shock you?
It shocked me a lot, and Chloe, I completely understand where you're coming from. When I saw the video, that's exactly what kids used to do to me, and even some adults, unfortunately. I'm 39 years old, and I still get a lot of stares and, you know, questions, which are fine, but sometimes people don't know how to approach it the correct way. But as a child, I was made fun of a lot of nicknames, and I've gone through therapy even for it. It's really sad how kids can be very cruel.
Mandy in Maryland. A Spanish billionaire art collector has been sentenced to 18 months in jail and fined $58 million for trying to smuggle a Picasso out of Spain to sell at auction. Jaime Botín, who's 83, will forfeit the work, Head of a Young Woman, which has been declared a national treasure. Here's our Europe regional editor, Mike Sanders.
Jaime Botín is one of Spain's richest men from the Santander banking dynasty. A court in Madrid heard that he bought the Picasso in 1977 and contacted the auction house Christie's in 2012. They advised him that he'd need an export certificate in view of the work's importance as a milestone on the way to Cubism. Instead, he stowed it in his superyacht, where it was seized by French customs off Corsica in 2015. The verdict means that the painting, worth an estimated $29 million, becomes Spanish state property. Mr. Botín can appeal.
Mike Sanders. Now, do you remember this?
84 Charing Cross Road, London, England. Gentlemen, your ad says that you specialize in out-of-print books.
I require a book of love poems with spring coming on. Yours, Elaine Hanf.
Dear Miss Hanf, we are sending by book post today a little book which I hope you will like. Yours faithfully, FPD, Marks & Co.
An excerpt from the 1987 film 84 Charing Cross Road, about a love affair between two people who never met. In 1949, a struggling New York writer, Helen Hanf, with a love of fine old books, responds to an ad placed by an antiquarian bookshop in London. Well, 71 years later, interest in such items lives on. The British author Neil Gaiman has said he's delighted that he was able to help a second-hand bookshop in the south of England to attract a whole host of new customers. The owner took to social media to lament that because of stormy weather, Tuesday had ended without the shop selling a single book. That led to an appeal by the writer to his legions of fans, and orders started flooding in online. Our correspondent, Duncan Kennedy, has been finding out more.
The Petersfield Bookshop is where quaint meets quirky. Established 100 years ago, it's a warren of shelves stocking everything from Churchill to Chaplin. But last Tuesday, it didn't see a single customer all day. That led the shop to put out a forlorn tweet which read, "Tumbleweed. Not a single book sold today. £0. We think this may be the first time ever." The message was spotted by best-selling author Neil Gaiman. He then retweeted it to his 2.7 million followers. The bookshop owner, John Westwood, says orders then came pouring in.
Someone from Inverness rung up and said, "I want to spend £10, don't care what the book is, just send it to me and I'm going to get my friends to do it." Someone from California wants to donate $50. And it's just the love for books. You cannot beat a book, you touch and feel them, they become like old friends.
The shop has gone from zero to 100 books a day being sold. They've had to take on volunteers to help. New customers who saw the tweet have been arriving all day.
A second-hand bookshop, an antiquarian bookshop like this, is a treasure trove of amazing things.
Family bookshops mean so much more than just any old bookshop, don't they? It's just amazing the different things that they have in it.
Independent shops like this have had to compete with everything from e-books to Amazon. And whilst they can't always be busy on a wet January afternoon, this one, like all the best books, really has captured the imagination.
And that report by Duncan Kennedy. Right, that reminds me. I must write to the Petersfield Bookshop. "Dear sir, or madam, I wonder if you have the following book, Fly Fishing by J.R. Hartley. In the meantime, that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm James Reynolds. Until next time, goodbye.
Capital One has a fresh take on banking. Now you can open a new savings account in about 5 minutes and earn five times the national average. Banking with Capital One means five times the savings toward your dream honeymoon, or five times the savings toward your family's ultimate vacation, even five times the savings toward just feeling good about saving. It's time to make your savings goals come true. This is Banking Reimagined. What's in your wallet? Capital One, N.A. member FDIC.